Welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. Check out our website at www.thewildernessmedic.com.
Expedition resources, wilderness medicine blog, and much more.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. My name is Daniel, and today I'm really pleased to be joined by Dr. Matt Creed, who is a consultant in anaesthetics, major trauma, and FEMS, a pre-hospital emergency medicine, based in Cardiff in South Wales. Thanks for joining me today, Matt.
Thank you for having me, Daniel.
So I think this is going to be a really interesting podcast. We're going to have a discussion about pre-hospital emergency medicine, explore some of the things that Matt has been up to, both in work and also with the basic scheme, and then also have a think about how some of the new research in FEM can kind of cross over and potentially be used in wilderness medicine. So it should be really exciting. So to start off with, I know that you're part of the MedServe basic scheme, which I've joined as a trainee member as well. I just wondered if you could tell the listeners a bit about basics and sort of its history and how it came to be.
Sure. I mean, if you look at the history of pre-hospital medicine more widely across the globe, while there are lots of similarities between provisions in pre-hospital care, they are notably different region to region, country to country, continent to continent. So the British Association for Immediate Care, also known as BASICS or the Association, is a charitable organization that represents immediate care provision in England and Wales. BASICS Scotland is a cousin organization of BASICS UK. And it's a sort of strong and vibrant professional association bringing together a wide range of individuals. One of the driving forces between a number of kind of developments in pre-hospital care in the United Kingdom over the last many decades. So they draw their history back to the mid-1960s, where if you consider the ambulance service care that existed in post-war sort of UK, the capabilities available in the pre-hospital environment were significantly more limited, and pre-hospital services, specifically ambulances, were very much transport platforms. So there was a general practitioner called Ken Easton who worked in Yorkshire and then Catterick around the A1, which is sort of busy and very dangerous motorway. And he basically started attending road traffic collisions, supported by, I believe it was some colleague who was a mechanic who had kind of like a wrecker vehicle, to rescue people who were trapped in road accidents and provide medical care and transport them to hospital. And then in the late 60s, he established a network of some 30 odd medical colleagues, covering about 1,000 square miles, providing physician support to the ambulance service as was at the time. And this essentially evolved into sort of a series of schemes providing what we now know as immediate care. And then in 1977, the British Association of Immediate Care Schemes, as was at the time, now the British Association for Immediate Care, was born through support with the Royal College of General Practitioners and has continued to support various regional schemes, national training, and its sort of improvement in pre-hospital care since.
That's really interesting, isn't it? And as a GP myself, it's nice to sort of hear how general practitioners were sort of at the core of that history, I guess. I suppose it's changed a little bit now in that yourself as an anaesthetist and many people sort of in FEM tend to be fewer GPs now, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's interesting when you consider how the subspecialty of pre-hospital emergency medicine has evolved in the United Kingdom. So, you know, as some of your listeners may be aware, the sort of UK medicals structure sees doctors complete their initial sort of foundation training and then move to specialize in various areas of medicine, be that primary care or in hospital care or otherwise. And the subspecialty of pre-hospital medicine focuses on the provision of pre-hospital critical care, although the term FEM, pre-hospital emergency medicine, is kind of used more widely to describe both the sort of sphere that we're working in, the environment. I think when you consider pre-hospital emergency care, I don't see that being sort of background specific. So there are loads of colleagues across a diverse ranges of both physician medical specialties and other healthcare professionals providing pre-hospital emergency care. And there are perhaps a smaller number, but again, a sort of diverse multidisciplinary teams providing pre-hospital critical care. And it's that critical care bit that you can subspecialize in as a sort of part of your certified training by the General Medical Council. But as you note, that's not something that is currently widely available to colleagues in primary care. However, I'm aware that there are a number of primary care physicians working, particularly in remote and austere medicine in the UK, that have mirrored the training that a specialty trainee would do in pre-hospital emergency medicine and have accredited themselves at the same level as those who have a subspecialty CCT in pre-hospital emergency medicine. So that's probably a long way of saying I don't think it's just hospital doctors or practitioners that add value in pre-hospital emergency care. And I think it's a pretty broad church.
Yeah, I think that sounds pretty reasonable. And I think the nice thing is as well about medical training now is whilst there are quite set curriculums, there are also other pathways. And, you know, as you said, having a multidisciplinary team within basics or within your pre-hospital care is really beneficial, isn't it? I think particularly in MedServe, we've got that sort of spread of skills as well. And it'd be great to just tell listeners, because we've mentioned MedServe a few times in passing, just a little bit about MedServe.
Yeah, of course. So I mentioned before that the British Association for Immediate Care has a number of kind of affiliated regional schemes. So MedServe Wales was formed in 1994. And again, Daniel, by a group of general practitioners who saw that there was an unmet need for enhanced medical care for ill and injured persons at the scene of an incident in South Wales. So initially our scheme was registered as the Mid Glamorgan Emergency Doctor Service, but was sort of colloquially known as MedServe. And the service later became simply MedServe Wales. And in 1994 in South Wales, there was no provision of enhanced care available beyond the statutory ambulance response. There was no pre-hospital critical care, and at that time, there were no regional air ambulance services either. And MedServe Wales have continued to provide this enhanced care to the people of South Wales for the past 28 years. We've currently got 9 solo responders. Those are individuals from a variety of backgrounds, both physicians and nurses, who can respond directly to the scene of an incident on blue lights in their own vehicles. And we've got a number of other responders, such as yourself, who can respond as part of a planned team deployment. And you know, our wider team and our solo responders will deploy at the request of the Welsh Ambulance Service NHS Trust 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And indeed, my colleagues and I have answered call outs, you know, on summer's afternoons, midwinter nights, Christmas Day. And I think the need is there. And our traditional model of calling for a basics doctor has changed significantly over the last 5 years. So our modus operandi for the first part of the organization's existence was very much that we provide these solo responders who could deploy to the scene with their enhanced equipment and medications and knowledge. But since 2018, we've run a team model, which we actually based upon a very successful scheme that operates out of the West Midlands near Birmingham, basically the West Midlands care team that a number of our team members have worked with. And we now run team shifts led by our tier one and tier two responders, with tier three members sort of staffing those shifts and progressing through our bespoke training pathway towards sign off at tier two level, and to support them completing the diploma in immediate medical care, the DIPIMC, which is run by the Faculty of Pre-Hospital Care as part of the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh, because we feel like our training pathway supports them to kind of cover that curriculum really well. And going through that kind of formal examination process helps our practitioners accredit themselves as well.
Yeah, I think that's really important, isn't it? I think having that credibility and some external validation is pretty important, obviously, within this sector, because I suppose different from our NHS jobs, it's all voluntary.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, I think that presents its own challenges in terms of the amount of time our various members are able to offer to the charity, both kind of clinically and otherwise. And then, you know, as perhaps some listeners will be kind of more aware, there's obviously then the kind of medico-legal impacts of providing voluntary care and integrating yourself within statutory organisations and so on. So yeah, it's an interesting field to work in.
Yeah, definitely. And you've mentioned a few times, I suppose, the terms enhanced care and immediate care as well with the diploma. I suppose if you had to sort of define enhanced care, what exactly do you mean by that? Is it sort of the knowledge and the kind of the procedures that responders can perform?
I think, so we've started using this term kind of regionally as within MedServe over the last kind of probably 8 to 10 years, I guess. And enhanced care to me is about the provision of a level of care which is above the standard ambulance service response. And I think it really defines those skills, interventions, knowledge that is not typically delivered by the non-specialist ambulance service response. And we also really use that term enhanced care to delineate from those responses that deliver critical care. As I mentioned before, the kind of subspecialty of pre-hospital emergency medicine focuses on pre-hospital critical care, and that includes the delivery of specific interventions and packages of care such as pre-hospital emergency anesthesia, provision of pre-hospital blood products, delivery of specialist equipment to stabilize and transfer neonates and children, carry out retrieval and transfer missions. And that's, in Wales supplied by a separate NHS commission service. But having said that, our enhanced care teams within MedServe Wales, for example, we can and we do deliver aspects of pre-hospital critical care in our service. So, for example, some of our responders and teams will be able to deliver pre-hospital emergency anaesthesia. We do deliver surgical procedures. We have specialist medications and so on. But I think enhanced care, it's more than just drugs and procedures. It reflects the fact that as a service, as an organization, MedServe delivers experienced senior clinicians from a multidisciplinary background, physicians, nurses, paramedics, often with more than 15 years training and experience in the environment, supporting our ambulance service colleagues. And also that we attend those jobs that may not necessarily locally reach the threshold for a critical care response. So our responders will go to isolated open fractures to, you know, help provide advanced analgesia, antibiotics, support crews with regional anaesthesia. Occasionally, we might go and provide sedation, for example, in the case of an acute behavioral disturbance or a psychiatric case that can be really challenging to manage within the framework of practice that exists within the ambulance service response, but doesn't actually require pre-hospital critical care, but equally doesn't really meet the criteria for hospital or community-based specialists to intervene at that level. So enhanced care is that whole package of things sitting in that space between what you normally get with an ambulance and what you might get with a specialist response.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. And that's, that reflects some of the things, I think, when I've been out on shift as well. I suppose it feels that kind of middle area at times.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting because the capability and the empowerment of our ambulance services colleagues working within the NHS ambulance services has been changing and moving forwards year on year over the past decade or so, which I suppose reflects the pace of practice in both kind of research applicable to the pre-hospital environment and the desire to make sure that things that are when they initially evolve are kind of niche specialist interventions roll out onto the ambulances. So when I first started providing pre-hospital responses, things like pelvic binders, intraosseous access, tranexamic acid, antibiotics for open fractures, all of these things were only delivered by enhanced and critical care services. And now regionally, that equipment is standard on our ambulance services. It's familiar equipment to our colleagues. They've got patient group directives to facilitate the administration of antibiotics for open fractures. So more and more of these things that schemes like MedServe and other basic schemes and the sort of critical care services have provided as specialists in the past are now becoming more standard.
That's really interesting, actually. And I know you're not that old, but particularly the pelvic binders only being a critical care intervention and TXA, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's interesting to reflect, how far we've come and this pace of progress. It'd be really interesting to see what is kind of part of a standard response in 10 years' time.
Yeah, no, that will definitely be. And I suppose that leads quite nicely on to sort of thinking about how you first started to get involved with, with FEM and also with basics in general.
Yeah, so, I mean, like many things, I suppose it's often due to luck as much as judgment. So I remember as a very junior doctor speaking to one of my now consultant colleagues who did a lot of motorsports medicine, and they were telling me about this scheme that they responded with, which was MedServe, and were explaining to me how they'd had to undertake additional training courses and gain additional experience and how they'd done these exams through the Faculty of Pre-Hospital Care. I thought this was kind of fascinating and kind of tucked the conversation away for sort of later in my career. And as a relatively junior doctor, I was involved in the provision of remote and austere pre-hospital emergency care and remote primary care during a phase where I worked with the military. And I then later moved on away from that kind of phase of my career back into hospital training in the West Midlands. And I was fortunate enough to meet a number of colleagues working in pre-hospital care there, one of whom is a gentleman called John Hall, who used to be the Secretary of the Faculty of Pre-Hospital Care. And like a great many people I've been fortunate to meet through my career, John was really kind and invited me into opportunities to experience things that were going on in pre-hospital care with the team that he worked with, participate in their clinical governance and their offline training. And he supported my development. And I was later put through some training to sort of help me provide blue light driving response and put in contact with the West Midlands care team in Birmingham. And I spent some time in that region for a few years. And then when I left the army and I came back to Wales, John and other contacts put me in touch with MedServe. And again, I ended up working with that same consultant colleague I mentioned earlier, who maybe like 8, 9, 10 years before had been telling me about these pre-hospital exams. And I was at the stage where I was ready to do that exam. So I took my diploma in immediate medical care and happened just to meet a couple of the other MedServe responders that were also completing it at the time. And so essentially, I basically turned up at the MedServe meetings, governance meetings, invited, I will add, and I made a nuisance of myself until I was invited to join. And having completed driver training previously, that was a big bonus because it meant I was able to progress on the pathway to becoming a solo responder with MedServe. And that the scheme has kind of developed over the last decade or so that I've been involved, and I'm now quite heavily involved with the training and the governance and the sort of charity financial side as well.
That's really interesting, yeah. Particularly the making a nuisance of yourself. I think that's something that I've learned sort of along the last few years. That's if you hassle people enough, they'll eventually start talking to you and things like that.
Yeah, and I don't think, you know, I think like anything in pre-hospital care, it's not about being pushy. And we joke about making a nuisance of yourself, but it's not really that. It's about just asking about those opportunities and continuing to ensure that people think of you when they become available, I guess, because everyone has to start somewhere, right? And it's not the case that you can expect to immediately transfer a set of skills from a particular environment. So say, for example, your standard primary care environment or your standard in-hospital environment, it's not appropriate to simply pick that clinician up and put them in the pre-hospital environment in the dark on a motorway at a multi-patient, multi-car RTC, because that's dangerous for them, it's dangerous for the patients, it's a dangerous environment. And so everyone needs kind of to find a way to start building the skills they need to be able to operate in that environment. And I think teams like MedServe, where you can have that offline training, that exposure to other people's practice through case discussions, and then that mentored exposure into the pre-hospital environment has to be the way forward for bringing people into pre-hospital care, into immediate care. But obviously there are limited schemes and platforms that have the opportunity to do that.
I think, yeah, that's certainly really valuable, I think, having that structure and that way. And I suppose if you had any other advice for people who were trying to, I suppose, get more involved with fair, more enhanced care as a career pathway, is there any other courses or any other things you'd suggest to them?
So I think there's probably two parts to that, aren't there? So if you want to be working in the pre-hospital sphere, it sort of depends on your professional background, I guess. So for all professionals, irrespective of registration in the UK, I think the British Association for Immediate Care is a good starting place. So they have a variety of different courses in pre-hospital emergency care. And then I think you kind of need to decide which aspect of the pre-hospital space you want to work in, because pre-hospital covers a huge range of stuff from event medicine to kind of voluntary response for the ambulance service and so on and so forth. And in the UK, certainly the St. John's Ambulance Service, they're a really well governanced system that you can gain exposure to the pre-hospital environment in. The recruitment into local basic schemes varies very much dependent on the ambulance service they work for. So some schemes have the kind of team response model as well as solo response model like we have in MedServe. Others are very much focused on the solo response model. Some ambulance service and some schemes are happy to have a Widener professional membership responding for them. Others still have more physicians than other sort of professional backgrounds. And, you know, whatever we do, we need to be adding value above the standard response, I think. I think I certainly caution my more, my less experienced doctor colleagues against diving into work with event medical companies or charities when they are relatively inexperienced, because I think the environment itself can be really challenging, and it takes time to realize that you can't directly transfer some of the skills that you might provide in your normal working environment in the pre-hospital environment in the same safe way. So I do caution my less experienced colleagues and say, look, if you're going to go and provide care as a physician for an event charity or an event company, you want to just do a bit of due diligence to make sure that organization and that environment is set up to support you, not only in terms of the equipment and the medications that they provide and their expectations on you as the practitioner, but also that they are providing ideally direct senior supervision to those less experienced clinicians and have a strong framework of robust clinical governance to make sure they're supported, because it is and has for many years no longer been acceptable to turn up to an event expecting equipment to be provided that you don't know what it is and that you don't know what your lines of supervision are and that you're not able to provide your care in a robust way. I think if you're talking about FEM, specifically pre-hospital emergency medicine subspecialty training, as we said before, that currently only sits within the in-hospital practitioners, and they need to have completed the common STEM training in either intensive care medicine, emergency medicine, or anesthetics. And to those individuals, I would say you need to be looking early in your first core training year at the national specifications for FEM training at the person specification. And then you need to go and speak to your training program directors and find out how you can make yourself competitive.
Yeah, that's a really thorough answer, actually. Some really interesting points there, particularly about event medicine and ensuring about the governance and things, because it's a thing that comes up quite a lot on some of the wilderness medicine courses I teach on, and the issues of sort of working outside an approved practice setting and having adequate supervision. Yeah, I agree, you can't really stress that enough, really. And I suppose that picks up on some of the challenges of working in that sphere of medicine.
Yeah, I guess so. And, you know, I think there are lots of different aspects to this. So if you consider maybe austere medicine, if you consider kind of provision of tactical or remote medical care within the military, irrespective of what country's armed forces you're working in, there's always going to be a need for organizations like that that train across a variety of harsh, remote, austere environments to be able to provide medical care and kind of evacuation. And they are going to have relatively more junior or less experienced practitioners from your kind of, in the UK, they're combat medics or medical assistants, or in the US, I think they're sort of corpsmen, aren't they? Those individuals are going to perhaps have less capability than a physician, but you still might have relatively junior physicians working quite remote to their support, but hopefully, you know, with lines of communication and evacuation channels up and escalating kind of pathway of care. If you're talking about expedition or wilderness medicine, if you're I don't know, if you're out doing a kind of high altitude expedition somewhere and you've joined as a relatively junior doctor, you know, to be the doctor for that expedition, and you've joined a company that's really put you through some robust training and it's made sure that you've, you know, maybe got training in mountain medicine and you've got appropriate quantities of equipment for kind of common ailments as well as those other emergencies. If you are unlucky enough to have a casualty to deal with, you might be able to offer a relatively more robust medical response than someone that perhaps has kind of joined up and just happens to be a doctor, maybe hasn't necessarily had the guidance around the equipment. So I guess there's always going to be a need for those less experienced practitioners being out and away from direct support. It's more about how we acknowledge that it is necessary to be able to both receive and give remote medical support to our less experienced colleagues. And I don't know how that works within the kind of expedition and wilderness medicine sphere, but the advances in telemedicines and communications over the last 15 to 20 years mean that that's definitely much more possible than it's ever been, right?
Yeah, I think that's it. As you say, I think if you, as long as you've got some of that knowledge and then a good top cover communications plan, then yeah, hopefully things should all work out. And that leads quite nicely on to, we've also been focusing quite a lot on pre-hospital emergency medicine. And then we also mentioned obviously the pace of how research has changed from pelvic binders and things initially being an enhanced care service. But there's sort of new research coming out all the time. And I'd just be interested to hear your thoughts on, I suppose, what you think translates from that sphere of work over to the more expedition and austere environment type of work.
Yeah, I think, well, that's a tough one. Like as you said, I mainly work in the kind of enhanced and critical care sphere, and the capabilities and the distances to definitive care that I deal with are really different to the remote or austere environment. And certainly, I think in the remote and austere environment, primary care is often as, if not more important than the provision of pre-hospital emergency care. But trying to stay in my lane, I guess, there have been some relatively recent publications in major trauma around the safety and the pharmacokinetics of intramuscular tranexamic acid. It's generally and certainly in Europe widely considered that the provision of tranexamic acid to patients suspected of having major trauma with ongoing bleeding is worth giving. And so I guess it's worth highlighting to people that do work in the remote and austere environment, it's really safe and effective to give intramuscular tranexamic acid. It's almost as safe and effective as giving it intravenously or intraosseously. And I can certainly think of potential scenarios, particularly within certain environments, be they wild or austere or tactical, where actually it might not be appropriate to get IV or IO access in someone that's bleeding, that's had major trauma and their initial essential care delivered. So there's some stuff from the last couple of years around IMTXA. And then kind of related to that, I suppose, there was a trial published in the UK called the Refill Trial, which was published in the Lancet Haematology by Crombie et al. And that was a really interesting, pragmatic pre-hospital trial looking at whether the provision of pre-hospital blood products was demonstrably superior to the administration of saline. And I'll let your readers go and do their own critical appraisal of the trial and its methodology and so on and so forth. But I think probably from that, I would reflect to those colleagues working in the austere or remote environments that actually the dogma about not giving any crystalloid fluid to trauma patients probably doesn't stand true. And in the context of the signals results from that refill trial, if you don't have access to pre-hospital blood products, fresh or lyophilized or otherwise, it's probably safe to give your hypotensive bleeding trauma patients aliquots of saline or other suitable crystalloid. That's not going to be harmful as you move them through your chain of evacuation back to definitive care, where they can be resuscitated with blood products and have definitive hemorrhage control.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? I'll put the links to both of those research articles in the description of the podcast as well. Lots of interesting things. We're getting towards the end of the podcast now. It's been really great to have a chat. I think it's given people a real flavor of sort of how they can get involved with pre-hospital emergency medicine or pre-hospital critical care. And hopefully they've got a bit of an understanding of some of the schemes in the UK. If anyone listening has sort of any experience of similar schemes internationally, it'd be really cool to hear from you. You can get in touch on Instagram or Facebook at The Wilderness Medic. And I will also put some links to MedServ in the comments and Basics as well, just so people can check them out. As we said earlier, MedServ is a charity, and any donations would be really welcome as well. It just remains for me to thank you, Matt, for giving up your time and having a chat about the topics that we have. It's been really fascinating.
Thanks for having me, Daniel. My absolute pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to our podcast, then check out our website, www.thewildernessmedic.com. If you're interested in being a guest on a future episode or writing a blog for us, then do get in touch, and don't forget to follow us on social media. Until next time, take care.